Let's see. Okay. Parshas Vayakel. Parshas Vayakel presents something extremely interesting. And by the way, I want you to know, you dodged a bullet so closely, I almost made you learn piyut tonight. I was going to teach the piyut for Shabbos Shkolim, which is pretty, I love it, but it's pretty dry stuff. So you got away really easy. I decided to have mercy on you. Parshas Vayakel, you shouldn't remember me with a yawn. Anyway, so Parshas Vayakel is extremely interesting because it represents something in the minds of some of the Mefarshim, because it is a moment where we see Moshe Rabbeinu as a populist. What do I mean by Moshe Rabbeinu as a populist? Oh, let's get a page number. I haven't even given you a page number. Okay, so in the Stone Chumash, page, what is it? 516. Okay, 516. And Jessica's not here. Is anyone following in the Hertz? Mark, is that a Hertz Chumash you've got?
No, stone.
It's a stone? Oh, boy. Okay, well, everyone at home know that we're missing Jessica, and as a result, those of you who are following in a Hertz Chumash, you could turn off your tape right now, because you're not going to understand a single word, because we don't know what page you're on. Okay, so the first pasuk speaks of Moshe Rabbeinu gathering the people in a special gathering, right? Just that very suggestive word, Vayakhel, from the word Kehillah, Vayakhel Moshe Eskol Adas B'nei Yisrael Vayomer Aleihem. And Moshe gathered together the whole congregation of the children of Israel, and he said to them, Eile haddivarim asher tzivo Hashem la'asos osam. These are the things which God has commanded to do them. And we will come back to the commanded to do them in just a few moments. But the Mefarshim ask a number of interesting questions. First of all, Rashi is going to say, Vayakel Moshe, and Moshe gathered together. When did this all take place? Says Rashi, Lemocharas Yom HaKippurim Kisheyarad Min Hahar. The day after Yom Kippur, which is when Moshe Rabbeinu came down from the mountains. It's when he came down, not for the first time, it's when he came down with the second set of Luchos, the second set of tablets, and it was a moment of rapprochement, a moment of forgiveness and peace and all those good things for the people. And it says, and the very next day he gathered them together and spoke to them about the Mishkan. Now the Kli Yokar here asks a very easy question. Those of you who have been paying attention know that when we learned in Parshas Yisro that on the next day Moshe sat down to judge the people, that was also day after that Yom Kippur. So the question is, what was Moshe doing on the day after that Yom Kippur? And this will take us, in the eyes of the Kli Yokar, to the very heart of the Vayakel of that particular gathering. Because he says, she asked me a question, was Moshe judging or was he giving directions about the Mishkan? And he tells us that Moshe was doing both. You see, because when the children of Israel first gathered at the foot of the mountain, right, they had been perfecting themselves through the days when they were journeying from Egypt, and they finally got to the foot of the mountain, and there it says, Vayichan Yisrael, and Israel encamped, Ki ish echad belev echad, Rashi says, like one united people. Right? Now, as you know, Jews can't go very long without an argument. Right? When is their best time? When do Jews get together? Well, they get together on Yom Kippur. When everybody says, you michael me, yeah, you michael me, yeah. You know Mr. Steinberg's famous old story? I tell you this every couple of years just to keep it fresh. These two very nice old gentlemen who've been having a feud for like 40 years, they decide, you know, they're both getting along in years. They figure, Erev Yom Kippur, they should get a fresh start. So one says to the other, you meichel me? Yeah. You meichel me? Yeah. So they decide, such a great occasion demands a lechayim. So they pour two drinks, and one says to the other, I wish for you, my friend, what you wish for me. The other one says, I thought you wanted to make up. So Jews managed to pull it together for Yom Kippur. And you can imagine on this Yom Kippur, when they were begging forgiveness from God for the sin of the golden calf, they had particularly gotten together. But what happens? As the late great Moms maybe would say, business is business. And the next morning, the markets opened, and before you knew it, this one claimed the other one owed him money. This one claims that the other one delivered shoddy goods. And before you know it, even on Motzei Yom Kippur, the next day,
they're fighting,
they're arguing about this and that. And Moshe says, you can't build a Mishkan if you're disunited. The house of God must and can only be built by people who are unified. And so he says to them, you know what? I'm going to sit down. And I'm going to settle all the disputes. Then when Moshe Rabbeinu sits down to judge all the cases that we heard about in Yisro, right after Yom Kippur, what Moshe Rabbeinu is essentially trying to do is to extend the harmony of Yom Kippur into the year, into the next day. And so Moshe Rabbeinu, it took him till about noon, he straightened everything out, and everybody received justice, and then he could open the discussion of Melechas HaMishkan. Then he could talk about building a house for God. But the Kli Yochar adds something else. The Kli Yochar says that Moshe had another reason for sitting in judgment, because he was about to do what our people does best. He was going to raise money. He was going to announce the new campaign for the building of the Mishkan. Only there was one problem. You can't build a Mishkan with dirty money. So it wasn't just a matter of settling things between people so that the partners in the Mishkan would be at peace. The sitting in judgment was to make sure that nothing was in anybody's pocket which wasn't his or hers by the highest standard of ethics. Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to make sure, before I ask you for money, I want to make sure that all of the money is clean. Because the history of the world is littered with examples of bad money trying to do good things. And that is a contradiction in terms. So Moshe Rabbeinu assured the righteousness of what people possessed, and then he asked them to share it. So in both dimensions, says the Kli Yochar, Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to make sure that the Mishkan would be built by a people at peace, and with goods that were wholly honest, and in the right hands. Now the discussion is picked up by the Orach Chaim HaKadosh. Now I don't know how many times I have reminded you of this, so please bear with me if I'm a nudnik. But when you mention the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, if you would like to fix him in history, Chaim Ibn Attar, I will help you remember him by the following story. There is a famous, famous legend that the Baal Shem Tov heard a rumor that there was a great Svardic mystic and Talmud Chacham living in Jerusalem. And he heard that this great rabbi was in possession of a manuscript of the book of Tehillim, of the book of Psalms, in the handwriting of King David. Now you could just imagine what such a thing would be. Unless King David was the first Jewish doctor, in which case you probably wouldn't have been able to read the Tehillim in his handwriting. But we assume that if David HaMelech wrote it, you could read it. And the Baal Shem Tov said, if the greatest mystic of Ashkenaz would join forces with the greatest mystic of Sfarad in Jerusalem, the two of them could force the Mashiach to come. And so the Baal Shem Tov set out on his famous journey to try to go to the land of Israel, and the Almighty decided that it wasn't quite time, and there are all sorts of stories about how his journey was diverted, and how he ended up in Istanbul for Pesach. And that is a story that we always tell on the eighth day of Pesach at the Baal Shem Tov Suda. So we know that he ended up in Istanbul. But for your purposes, before I teach you the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, what you need to remember is the Or HaChaim HaKadosh is that rabbi that the Baal Shem Tov was trying to get to in Yerushalayim. He is the other bookend, if you will. So if you will remember that when the Baal Shem Tov, if I'm not mistaken, was born at the end of the 17th century, about 1698. Somebody's going to listen to this and tell me I'm off. For some reason I remember that date. The Baal Shem Tov is born in 1698 and of course flourished during the first half of the 18th century, which was quite a century. Then you'll be able to fix both the Baal Shem Tov and the Or HaChaim. You'll know what we're talking about. We're talking about an event in the years probably toward the middle of the 1700s. Okay? At some point in this period, George Washington was probably born. So you're talking about a time when the Baal Shem Tov and George Washington were alive at the same time. Okay, so great things were happening in those days. What does the Or HaChaim HaKadosh say? The Or HaChaim HaKadosh asks a very simple question, Stanley. He says, every page you turn in the Chumash, Vayadaber Hashem HaMashel Emar, Daber al Bnei Yisrael, and God says to Moshe, speak to the children of Israel and tell them, saying. Right? We do a lot of saying when we tell them. So yes, so I'll ask you a wonderful question. How come here he had to make such a production? Here it has to start up by Yakhel Moshe as Koladas B'nai Yisrael. He had to make a special convocation of the congregation of the children of Israel. And the Or HaChaim HaKadosh answers, you know what happened? In the end of Parshas Kisisa, we encountered the phenomenon of Koran Or Panav. That Moshe came down from the mountain and his face shone with a holy light. And the people pulled back. And the people, he had to put on the veil. Right? Now if you'll notice, at the end of Parshas Kisisa, I mentioned this a little bit on Shabbos, if you happen to have been in the big shul, it says, Vayir'um mi geshes elav. And the people were afraid to come near him. And Rashi there has a very poignant comment. And he says, do you see what damage sin can be? These were the people who just a little while before gazed upon God as a fiery presence, and now they couldn't even look at the glow in the face of Moshe. See how far they had descended. But they were embarrassed. They were afraid of him. Because while they had been descending, he had been ascending in his holiness. And so they were afraid. So Moshe says, Don't be afraid. By Yitzavim, by Achrechein, I'm sorry, Pasuk, Vayikra Alehem Moshe. And Moshe called them, Vayoshuvu Elov, and they returned to him. First, Aaron v'chol anasim ba'eda, it was Aaron and then all of the princes, and Moshe spoke to them. The Acharechein Nigshu Kol Bnei Yisrael, the Bnei Yisrael. And we know that Bnei Yisrael always means sort of the better folk. So Moshe Rabbeinu is saying, what's going to happen to me for the rest of my life? Am I only going to speak to the elite? Am I going to be frightening to the regular people? So that's why, says the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, Vayakel Moshe es kol adas b'nei Yisrael. Moshe gathered everyone, and as the Midrashim say, this time it included literally everyone, meaning even all the children, women, everyone. Even the people who are not so learned and certainly not necessarily so righteous. But Moshe wanted to bring them in as well, because they had just been distanced. Isn't that interesting? And there is a Zoharic tradition that the Or HaChaim HaKadosh quotes, mystical tradition from the Zohar, where the Zohar says that in this convocation, the men stood separately. You know, men and women were separate because it was very holy. It was like with a mechitza. It was, you know, like a Hasidish wedding. But the Or HaChaim HaKadosh says, make no mistake, it does not mean that Moshe spoke only to adult men. It means that although they stood separately in order for things to be modest and for there to be decorum, everyone was there. Everyone had a place to stand. Because Moshe Rabbeinu's mission transcended gender and age. And he had something to say to everyone. Because if he hadn't, we would have been left at the end of Parshas Kisisa with this notion that Moshe would speak only to the elite, and the elite would be the connection to the people. And this would have been, in a certain sense, this would have been very poetic. Why? Because the people said to Moshe, you talk to God, and then you'll tell us what he said. So what's going to happen now? We're going to make another layer? So Moshe will talk to God, and then he'll only talk to Aaron, or to the princes, and the people will have it twice removed. Right? Not only will they not hear it from God, now they won't even hear it from Moshe. And Moshe says none of that. Vayakel Moshe es kol adas b'nei Yisrael. Moshe says, I will allow no barrier between me and you. He said, because you have to remember, it broke Moshe Rabbeinu's heart that the people did not want to stand and listen to God themselves in the entirety of his teaching. Because he felt that somehow he had failed. Because what good did it do to bring the people to Har Sinai when all he wanted them to do was to stand with God? All he wanted to do was to connect them to the Torah so kivayocha he could disappear. And they, because they were afraid, they positioned him. You know, we always say, you know, like even when you sing Yigdal, it's one of the principles of the Rambam, that there can be no other prophet like Moshe Rabbeinu, who had this direct relationship with God. I mean, Lulei de Istefino, I'm nobody. But I think that every time Moshe hears that, he weeps. Because that's never what he wanted. This most modest of human beings. All he wanted was to bring his people to God. And when that's why he says, would that all of God's people were prophets. Right? When Nadav and Avihu are, I'm sorry, when the Dud brothers, Eldad and Medad, don't they sound like something from Nashville? Here they are, the Dud brothers. Come on out here, Eldad and Medad. Play them banjos for us. I always think that. But anyway, they were, and Yoshua's going, no, they're prophesying, Moshe Rabbeinu, they think they're Nevi'im. He says, halavai, everybody would be a Navi. And then I could just, I don't know, go teach kindergarten. But it wasn't to be. But more layers, more bureaucracy, more people to tell you, I heard it from Moshe, but you're not big enough, you wouldn't understand. Huh. And the question of you wouldn't understand is a very interesting question. Why? He said, why? Because several of the Mefarshim read the verses, the presentation of Shabbos here in Vayakhel, in the light of this realization that the audience here is not the elite. The audience here is everyone. And according to that, there is a tenor, there is a psychology of discourse which is different from the one when Moshe speaks as lawgiver. Because when, normally speaking, when Moshe Rabbeinu speaks as lawgiver, what do you end up with? Well, we know what you end up with. We end up with words so precise that Rabbi Akiva could find halachic significance in every, as they use, my grandfather used to say, every tittle of a yud. Right? Each of the little crowns. Everything had meaning. Everything required hermeneutics. You know what hermeneutics is? It's not named after a guy named Herman. That is incorrect. Because then it would have been another one named by his brother Seymour, or it would have been semeneutics. That's semiotics, not named for Seymour either. Hermeneutics means the discovery of hidden meaning. Right? To be able to dig into the meaning of something. And so most of our tradition as it exists, as the legacy of Moshe, the great lawgiver, is a tradition which requires great hermeneutic skill. Can I challenge everyone, sometime in the next 24 hours, in your daily conversation, like when you pick up your dry cleaning, right, or you go down to take your mail from the mailbox, try to slip hermeneutics into a sentence. When you're just talking to regular, tell a cab driver, my, what an interesting sign. It requires hermeneutical excellence just to figure out how much this ride is going to be. People will think you're talking dirty. Hermeneutics. Just think of somebody named Herman and then you'll remember it. Hermeneutics. Okay, I just wanted to give you that because I don't want you to be without a hobby. You know what I'm saying? You have to have little fun things in your day to get you going. Okay, so I'm sending you into the world with hermeneutics. In any case, the Netziv says, this Parsha is different. He's not the only one who's going to say this, but the Netziv says, it's so interesting that, what did he say after all? Let's take a look at the first thing he says to them. And there's a little bit to say on this pasuk, but let's look at the next one. It says, "Sheshes yomim te'osem melacha." In 6 days shall work be done. Uvayom hashvi'i yelochem kodesh. And the seventh day it will be to you holy. Shabbos Shabboson LaShem, a Sabbath unto God. Kol ha'osev v'melacha yumos, anyone who does work there will die. Now, there are many formulations of the laws of Shabbos. The Netziv is fascinated here because he says there are things which come out of this pasuk which are not exactly halacha. So you're going to say to me, what are you talking about? What else can there be? So, for instance, the Netziv notes that the work shall be done, shall be completed in 6 days. Well, what does that mean? That sounds like it's referring to the work. Technically speaking, There is nothing wrong as long as you're not doing it, Mark. If the thing finishes itself, the work finishes itself on Shabbos. So, for example, suppose you are dyeing something. You know, you're dyeing a piece of cloth. And you put dye on it, you do whatever you do, Thursday night, whatever. And you just leave it over Shabbos. And it's becoming more and more, I don't know how this stuff, I don't do this
gets
stuff.
The color gets
don't in. Try this at home. And it gets more and more profoundly colored. And comes Friday night, you light candles, you make Kiddush, and this thing is dying and dying. You think by the end it would be dead, after all this dying. But it's dying and dying. It's going on over into Shabbos. That's not a Shabbos violation. You didn't break Shabbos.
Right.
But, says the Netziv, when it comes, and the Netziv has this idea all on his own. It's not found in any earlier source. He says when it came to the constructive activity for the Mishkan, work that did itself, so to speak, a process that continued onto Shabbos by itself, they didn't do. In other words, more than the usual restriction on Melach on Shabbos. But, says the Netziv, it went further. The common folk extended this notion of something that is done but not that no Jew does. And they extend it into a very interesting area, he says, and he has two other examples. He says, the fact that we do not allow non-Jews to bury a Jew on Shabbos is from this concept that melacha shall not be done by itself, by others, by non-Jews. Now, under certain circumstances, of course, we allow a non-Jew to do certain things for us. But the idea was, this is even more, that it was somehow, it is considered to be a disgrace, a disrespect to the departed person that melacha was done on his or her behalf, even if it wasn't done by a Jew. And he says, that's the source. The extrapolation from this, he goes even further. There is a halacha in one of the slightly off the main road tractates known as Demai, right? One of the tractates that has to do with taking trumas and maestros, the various things that have to come off of grain, right? And it has to do with the fact that not every person is equally reputable. Not everyone is believed if you ask them, did you, because, you know, Stanley, in the times of the Mishnah, the big kashrus problem was not meat. In other words, it was assumed most meat was slaughtered by people who knew what they were doing. Like, it was very hard in Eretz Yisrael to find a treif butcher shop. You know the famous story about Ben-Gurion? That in the early years of the state, he was complaining that he had trouble finding treif meat. And they said, don't worry, put it in your pot and it'll be treif. So that nobody worries about, the Gemara doesn't worry a lot about meat. I mean, it has laws about how to keep it kosher, but it wasn't lurking in every, you know, you weren't worried that some guy was going to serve you something that wasn't kosher. You know where they were nervous? They were nervous with fruits and vegetables. Fruits and vegetables because you have to take, no, not the worms. Oh, please, Florence, the worms, you're making me nauseous. No, they were worried that people didn't take off the gifts for the priests, the truma, and then the tithe for the Levi, and then the Levi had to take his own tithe and give it back to the Kohen. So you were not allowed to eat things which were untithed. And the idea was that some of the people, the more simple, uneducated people, who in the very technical language were called Ame Haaretz, people of the land, but I mean, the definition of that category is someone you cannot trust. If he tries to give you, I don't know, corn on the cob, Stanley, asparagus, be very careful. Be very, very careful if it's grown in Israel, right? Because the problem was, did he or did he not take miser? strange halacha in Maseches Demai. Demai says that if you go up to an Am Haaretz, one of these people who's generally disreputable, on Shabbos, and you ask him, is this fruit, is this food tithed? And he says, yes, you may believe him. You know why? Strangest thing. He says, because an Am Haaretz won't lie on Shabbos. Isn't that interesting? On Shabbos, he wouldn't lie. Do you think you have permission to lie on Wednesday? No. Why? Because of this pasuk, he says, "Koda kodesh." You shall experience it as holy. He gives it, and that is enough. And that is not a halachic category, so to speak. It is what we might call a meta halachic category, or perhaps even what we might call a folk halachic category. And what is remarkable is that according to the way the Netziv approaches this parsha, Moshe the populist is creating exactly these categories. Not the categories where people will learn from a rabbi how to observe Shabbos, but a sensibility of Shabbos. The kind of thing where a person feels, on this day, I wouldn't do an Avera. I'd do it on another day. All right, another day is another day. But Shabbos. Shabbos.
Totally.
Like the kind of people who won't talk Lashon Hara on Shabbos. You think it's any better on Tuesday? But Shabbos. The Netziv says this is the point of origin of that mysterious level. And I believe that the Netziv means by this, by implication, to account for all of those things that are in the groundwater, that are in the fabric of the Jewish soul, of truly traditional people, even when they are not learned.
Is that what comes when someone says espasnet?
I think you're right. Espasnet may also derive from a certain, once upon a time, Jewish people aspired to this adjective called balabatish. What a refined person would do. But as pasnish is part of that, I think these all may be connected. I'll tell you one, the people who raised me, my mother's mother's mother, right? The female line, they worried about the Ayin Hara all the time. Like the Ayin Hara was like it was chasing them. Right? And as much as that did involve a certain measure of superstition, right? I told you all the time that when I had to give a speech, like at an elementary school graduation or junior high or something like that, and they would use it, they always gave me the valedictorian speech that no one wanted. You know, like, you can speak in Urdu. I used to give these beautiful speeches. No one knew what the heck I was talking about. Because, like, I was the Hebrew valedictorian, the Watusi valedictorian. You know, they always gave me some language no one understood.
It doesn't matter. What you say is how you said it.
Oh, a lot of expression. E pluribus unum, my good man. So, but my mother was afraid that even though I was given usually the dog of the valedictory addresses, because no one knew what I was talking about, so it was okay. Nevertheless, the Ayin Hara was out there, right? You got to be careful, because some days the Ayin Hara is not picky. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a person who comes in at the end of a kiddush. They don't care. They'll lick the egg salad off the radishes. They're not by that. So the Ayin Hara, some days, he's not picky. He'll take a Hebrew valedictorian. You know what I'm saying? Gives him crazy indigestion, but he'll take anything. So my mother, she should rest in peace, used to send me into these things. I had to have my Reta Bendela.
Oh, you had a Reta Bendela.
That wasn't bad. It was the knobel. I had to go with garlic. I was once introduced by the principal as a lasagna. I smelled like God knows what when I... But that eye in horror business, you know what that taught us?
Well, that's the evil eye.
That's what they translated as. The eye in horror trained you, do not show off. Do not brag.
Don't boast.
That if you're blessed, if you've achieved a little something, if you have something nice in your life, just remember, there's someone else who's not as lucky.
Oh my goodness!
And you don't need to break their heart. Mm. You don't need to make them. You don't need to stoke the fires of envy. It is exactly the opposite theory of the whole Facebook generation, which wants to put themselves out, makes me crazy. Why? Because that is part of this layer of folk tradition that the Netziv was so anxious to connect to Moshe Rabbeinu himself that he should know that these people had categories which were sacred, even if they couldn't be traced to a particular paragraph in the Talmud or in the Shulchan Aruch. He tells us, he gives one more example, it's really interesting. He says that Yehoshua, when they conquered the city of Jericho, they prohibited the people from touching it, from touching the loot. And there's a midrash which says the reason for that was because it was conquered on Shabbos. It's conquered on Shabbos. And even though this was not halacha, from this sensibility of Yiyeh Lachem Kodesh, Shabbos has to be holy to you. The people, this prohibition grew from the people. Conquered it on Shabbos, as maturin it. You can't touch it. And interesting, the Rabbeinu Bechaya comes from the same general concept as the Netziv, but he comes in another direction. He says that the Shabbos, as it is presented here, it's not a question that it's not presented in all of its halachic detail. He says, no. He says, it's presented this time, but without the mystical layers. See, because Shabbos actually is a mystical phenomenon that has, you know, implications through the universe. It's not just... Rabbeinu Bechaya says that the Shabbos here is presented in its stripped-down version, differently from the way it was presented in other places, to teach us that you are allowed to protect the common people from things that will baffle and confuse them. You are allowed to teach the Torah without going in to all of its mystical dimensions. And indeed, that is for the way you teach has to be matched to the subtlety and the understanding of the audience which you address. So this then, for the Rabbeinu Bechaya, the fact that the Shabbos of Vayakhel is presented in a different style than the Shabbos which is presented in other parts of the Torah, is in order to demonstrate the rules of pedagogy, in order to demonstrate that a teacher has the obligation to know the audience, to present them with the Torah in the form that will be most nourishing to them. So I have in my mind, mostly from Tzipora, I have this picture of her grandfather, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And everyone knew that, you know, that the Rav could enthrall an audience of the most learned people. I mean, the big Russia yeshiva used to send spies to find out the Torah that the Rav was teaching, because it was so great. But to me, even more remarkable, I think it was Fridays, the Rav used to go into Maimonides school, and he would pull over a little chair, and he would teach the little ones, the first graders, and the kindergarten children. And the Rav always knew how to enter the heart of a child, how to explain the most exquisitely pure Torah concepts, so that someone who heard them from the Rav when they were 5 and 6 years old carried them for the rest of their lives. That is what makes him the heir to Moshe Rabbeinu. That is the Moshe, according to the Rabbeinu Bechaya, that is the Moshe of Vayakhel, who could gather, it tells you, so the Mishra says, he gathered the ladies and all the kids, you can imagine it was bedlam. And all of a sudden, Moshe Rabbeinu spoke to them and everything was quiet. And everybody connected. Everyone, when Moshe spoke, they could see the Mishkan that he was describing, and see what it would be like to have God living in their neighborhood. Now, one last thing, and this is courtesy of the Abarbanel, but actually my own riff on the Abarbanel, not the riff as in Rabbeinu Alfasi, riff as in music. On the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel quotes, really it's the Ramban's tradition, and says that all of this is taking place in the wake of the sin of the golden calf and the forgiveness. And the people were virtually hysterical with grief and shame and anguish and fear. We know what almost happened because we have the dialogue between God and Moshe. Hashem almost sent us into history without him. I'll give you an angel. I'll pay off everything I promised, even though you're a bunch of bums. But don't talk to me. Moshe said, we're not having that. So what the Ramban says is it's true. Moshe Rabbeinu went over things that everybody knew already, that everyone had already heard about the Mishkan, and everyone had already heard about the Shabbos, only they thought they were gone. And so when Moshe Rabbeinu came down and said, we're moving forward with the Mishkan, and after all of this, God is coming to live here with us, the people were ecstatic. Why? Because much more remarkable than getting something is getting back something you thought you had lost. And the joy with which the Shabbos and the Mishkan rushed back into their lives was beyond description. What's interesting here, the Mishkan didn't come right back, you see. The Mishkan came with the reminder to keep Shabbos. You know why? Because these people had lost the chance to have God close. And for them, every moment until there was a Mishkan, until there was a place for the divine presence, every moment was painful. It was like holding your breath. I tried this one time. I don't know why, I'm a sick individual. When I was in Boston, I would walk to shul in Boston. I once wanted to know, could I hold my breath the length of 2 blocks? Time I got to the end of the second block, I was like going crazy. I was seeing spots. I should know, they have avenues in Boston. Anyway, so I just wanted to see if I... But imagine if holding your breath and not being able to live in a Mishkanless world. And Moshe says, I know there is this notion that we have to abandon all restraint because we got to get us a Mishkan ASAP. He says, no. Sheshes yomim teosem locho v'yom ha-shvi yelochem kodesh shabbos shabbos al-mashem. even for Melechus HaMishkan, even for that without which you cannot imagine the world one single moment, you have to stop for Shabbos. And Shabbos allowing the world to be 25 hours with no progress to the Mishkan reminded them that that is also part of cultivating the presence of God. Cultivating the presence of God in those moments when your hands are tied. In those moments when you are shackled and there is nothing you can do. And in those moments to remember there's a God in the world and everything will get done and there will be a dwelling place for Him and He will dwell among us. We'll pause there. Catch you next week. Pray for a continuance on your being let off of Piyutim.